Yeah, so. What are we going to talk about today?
If nobody else has anything to talk about, can we go over the Four Noble Truths and maybe go into some depth on dependent origination in specific as well, but
Okay.
maybe also go over all of them?
Okay. Well, the first is the truth of the nature of suffering. And it's the truth of the nature of dukkha. It's not really the truth of the nature of suffering. That's just a kind of distortion introduced by Westerners in trying to translate dukkha and focusing on the most severe forms of dukkha. Dukkha is unpleasantness. Of the three types of feelings that we can experience, there are pleasant feelings, there are unpleasant feelings, and they're neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And dukkha is unpleasant feelings. Okay, so we could translate it as unpleasantness. We could also translate it as dissatisfactoriness, because dissatisfactoriness captures some more of the subtlety of dukkha. Because, and of course, severe pain is unsatisfactory, right? And it's unpleasant. But to use the term dissatisfactoriness, we acknowledge that dukkha includes the feelings that we sometimes have of just something, of not being right, of life being unsatisfying. So, the truth about dukkha that the Buddha elucidated was, first of all, is that there were two kinds of dukkha depending on its origins, and that there is dukkha of physical origin, which we would call pain and discomfort. It's the dukkha that's associated with the body. And the other kind is the dukkha that originates in the mind, the mental dukkha. It would include that feeling of unsatisfactoriness I described. It would include every kind of mental unpleasantness that we experience. He pointed out that pain, as it is experienced by ordinary people, is a mixture of the two. That an unpleasant sensation in the body elicits a reaction in the mind. The mind resists it, so it generates mental dukkha, which is like an amplification. And it's good always to keep in mind when thinking that mental dukkha is amplifying physical dukkha, that you should always think of it in the way that Shinzen Young expressed it, as a multiplying factor, that you have X amount of physical dukkha, and then whatever mental dukkha that you generate in response to that, the two are not added together, but they're multiplied by each other. Because this helps to capture the nature of the dukkha we experience in life. So the Buddha pointed out in the First Noble Truth that there are many, many sources of dukkha of physical origin, beginning with birth, which itself is somewhat painful and unpleasant, right through death, which is likewise painful and unpleasant, and that there is a huge amount of dukkha, physical origin, that happens in between. And he points out that there is a great limit in terms of what we can do about that kind of dukkha, that we spend a lot of our life trying to avoid that particular kind of dukkha, and it's right that we should, that we should not suffer physical pain unnecessarily. The other kind of dukkha, the mental dukkha, includes, of course, the mental dukkha that we generate in response to physical dukkha, which amplifies it in a multiplicative way. But there's vastly more mental dukkha in our lives than there is physical dukkha. Then the most important thing that he pointed out was that just as we can't, no matter how hard we try, we can't completely avoid physical dukkha, it's part of being the kind of beings we are in this world, that the mental dukkha is something that we have the potential to change, to diminish, to avoid. So that's essentially the first truth, the nature of dukkha. One other thing that comes in various places in his teachings is the acknowledgement that pleasantness and unpleasantness, what corresponds to dukkha is the word sukha, and that's pleasantness. That's whatever is pleasurable, either physically or mentally. And he points out that these aren't two totally different things, but rather they are really, they exist on a continuum, and there is a pure ultimate bliss, a sukha at one end, and there is the worst imaginable suffering, the maximum dukkha at the end point. And that most of the time we're somewhere in between on the spectrum, and we are experiencing a mixture of dukkha and sukha. Sometimes the amount of sukha is so small that we feel as if there's none at all. But in most cases, unless we're as far as you can go at the extreme, there's always some pleasantness present. And likewise, in all of the different things we do to find pleasure in our life, both mental and physical, there is a component of dukkha as well. Now, in the second noble truth, it's the truth of the cause of dukkha. Let's say the cause of dissatisfactoriness and unpleasantness. And now we're no longer really, what is the cause of unsatisfactoriness? What does it mean to be dissatisfied? Taking that particular meaning of dukkha. The feeling that is present is unpleasantness. But what does it mean to be dissatisfied, to be in a state that we're experiencing unpleasantness? It means that we are resisting what is. And so now we have identified the cause of mental suffering. So when we're experiencing physical pain, the disease or injury, or any other source that you can imagine, even mild unpleasantness like an itch or something like that, the physical sensation is a real phenomenon. But because we resist that physical sensation, we create the mental dukkha that multiplies the unpleasantness. And resistance and dissatisfaction are really one and the same. So if you analyze it deeply enough, what we often hear is that craving is the cause of dukkha. We look at it more closely and we say, well, craving is wanting things to be different than they are. Whether it's wanting to have something pleasant that you don't have, or whether it's wanting some unpleasant thing not to be there. It's wanting things to be different than they are. In other words, craving is resistance. Craving and resistance are the same thing. And mental dukkha is dissatisfaction. And dissatisfaction and resistance are the same thing. So, you know, if we were in math class in junior high school, we'd write it out that, you know, craving equals resistance, and then we'd write down below it, resistance equals dissatisfaction, and then we would combine the two equations and we'd cross out the two in the middle, and we'd find that craving equals dukkha. Oh, I forgot, we should put, and dissatisfaction equals dukkha. So then we cancel out everything in the middle, and what we end up with is that craving actually equals dukkha. So it's not really quite true. In practical terms, it's true. We crave, therefore the reaction to our craving is dukkha. But when we look deeply enough, we find that craving and dukkha are really not different. They're really the same thing. And that we've made the distinction between the physical dukkha, which there's very little we can do about, and we should do what we can about. And then there's the mental dukkha, which if we could understand well enough how our mind works and why our mind generates dukkha, then we might be able to change what our mind does. So this was the great, wonderful discovery that the Buddha made. You could say that the first noble truth is that pain and discomfort, dukkha of physical origin, are inevitable. But what he had discovered through his own awakening, through overcoming craving, is that mental dukkha is optional. We don't have to produce that. When he taught the truth of suffering, he didn't teach it just as an intellectual explanation as I've given it to you. He asked that what we do is we be mindful of dukkha and sukha, pleasantness and unpleasantness, satisfaction and dissatisfaction. And we verify for ourselves exactly what he had said. Because throughout his teaching, he insisted, I'm telling you things that I've discovered, but you don't have, there's no reason for you to take my word for any of it, because you can verify it for yourself. And so with the first noble truth, go and verify it for yourself. The same is true for the second noble truth. And it's that if you can let go of the resistance, even for a short period of time, you'll find that the mental suffering disappears. If the dukkha that you're experiencing is entirely mental, you're feeling hurt, you're experiencing some loss, any of the forms of mental dukkha that you can think of that don't arise in reaction to some physical pain or discomfort, as soon as you let go of the resistance that dukkha actually is, the dukkha is gone. And the same thing if you're experiencing physical pain. If you let go of resistance to the physical pain, as soon as you do that, the multiplying factor of mental dukkha goes away at the same time. So this is something, the second noble truth is something that you can, that anyone can demonstrate for themselves. But of course, the problem is, you can demonstrate it for yourself, but you can't stop the resistance, you can't eliminate the dukkha, generally for more than a very short period of time. It may be only seconds, maybe longer, but only seconds. So, now the second third noble truth is that the complete cessation of craving that will produce the complete cessation of dukkha requires that we penetrate the illusion that causes us to crave and therefore experience dukkha. So what the third noble truth is saying is that the path to the complete ending of dukkha is to cut through the illusion that causes craving. In other words, the end of craving and dukkha requires the end of delusion. That the reason we crave is that we're deluded. And the reason we suffer is that we crave. So, now that's a truth that you also must verify for yourself, but it takes more work to verify that. The fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Path, really is the path that leads to eliminating the ignorance and delusion that leads to the craving and the suffering. And so that's the Four Noble Truths. So, essentially the truth of the cause, or the truth of the nature of suffering, nature of dukkha. Let's stick with the word dukkha so that we don't mistake what it is. That the nature of dukkha is that although the physical part is inevitable, the mental part is something that we can do something about if we understand its origins. The second truth is that its origins are through our resistance, and our resistance is itself the dukkha. The third noble truth is that there is an end to dukkha. The end of ignorance that causes dukkha brings the end of dukkha. And the fourth noble truth is how we get to there from here. What more could I say about it?
There's another word that I've heard being used in relation to dukkha, and that's tana, I think.
Tana is the word that means that when I say craving, I mean tana. Yeah. And it's good for us to look at that and understand that, okay? There's a huge amount of confusion around the meaning of that word, the significance of it. We can talk about, we can say that craving is of two sorts. It's desire and it's aversion, okay? Now, the thing that immediately comes up for people when they hear that is, oh, I should never have any kind of desire at all. That all desire the goal of Buddhism is to eliminate all desire and all aversion and make myself into some kind of totally non-feeling being. And it's amazing how many Buddhists think that. But it's not the truth at all. When we say desire, if we looked at the words the Buddha used when he taught, he used two different words. One signified the desire that was craving. Okay, Tanha literally means thirst, and it's like an analogy that when the unwholesome kind of desire has this painful, unpleasant, powerfully compulsive quality to it, that just as that you have when you're experiencing powerful thirst. There's another word that he used, chanda, as in Dhamma Chanda.
As in what?
Dhamma Chanda. And it's our in joke, right? And this is that not all desire is unwholesome. Not all desire is tanha. Not all desire is craving. There is also the desire for, and this is what confuses people, the desire for awakening, the desire for an end to personal suffering, a desire for the end of suffering for other beings, the desire for good things, the desire that there be beauty in the world. An artist could create a piece of work out of tanha, but I think the greatest artists are driven not by tanha, but by chanda. When we decide that we are going to pursue the path of awakening, that desire, it has some tanha in it. It's like, oh, I want this thing for myself. But it also has a huge component of chanda. And the farther you go, the more chanda and the less tanha there is. So the wish to help somebody, the wish to give someone else pleasure, the wish even to relieve your own suffering in a wholesome way rather than in a compulsive way is chanda, and it's the good kind of desire. Likewise with aversion. Now, there is actually a wholesome kind of aversion. If I saw someone beating you, that would create in me the desire to do something to end that. Now, I could resist what is, and then I would experience suffering because I see that somebody's beating you. but that's not going to do you any good, and I'm going to suffer. On the other hand, I can experience chanda, which is the pure compassionate wish that what's being done to you cease, and I can attempt to take some kind of action to bring an end to that. If I've accidentally grabbed onto something that's burning hot, then I can experience either the powerful, unwholesome aversion to the heat, or I can experience the wholesome aversion that says, this is damaging my hand. This is harmful to me. Let me let go of it. So there are these two sides to desire and aversion that our simple translations sometimes mislead us by. But when we use the word craving when we're talking about the Dhamma in English, we should always remember that we're talking about the unwholesome forms of desire and aversion. And that's what the word tanha refers to. Tanha, literally meaning thirst, is craving, and that is unwholesome desire and aversion. Not too complicated. But when it's oversimplified, then people totally miss the point. They think, I shouldn't care about anything. I shouldn't, even to desire to become awakened or desire to help somebody else. Oh, that's a desire. That must be bad. Or aversion. That, well, if I were to want to go and try to make things better for somebody in the world and improve the terrible things that are happening, that's just aversion and craving. And as a Buddhist, I don't do those kinds of things. I just sit in bliss and let the world go to hell. The second path in the four-path model of awakening, it's that part of our spiritual development where we really learn the difference between tanha and chanda. And we arrive at that path when we come to the place that we realize that it becomes glaringly obvious to us that whenever there's tanha present, that there's dukkha present. That tanha and dukkha are the same thing. And that even though having achieved the first path, and even though we've continued to practice and advance in our spiritual development, that there is so much less tanha and so much less suffering than before, there comes a point where we realize that it's like a poison, and the tiniest bit of poison, spoils the whole drink, so to speak, right? And at the same time, we realize that we realize the truth of chanda. So we understand and distinguish between tanha and chanda, and we begin the work of the second path. Just that realization weakens tanha, and it allows us in a situation to separate the two. Remember I said they're often mixed. There's often some tana and there's often some chanda, and they're all often, and so some of the work of the second path is to learn to discern the difference between those two. And this brings us to a very interesting thing. Exactly the same experience, devoid of tana, is pure sukha. It's extremely pleasant. And this is another thing that Shinzen Young has articulated very well, and that I borrow from him. I just borrow the expression of it. The truth is universal and has always been there. That when you have succeeded in eliminating tanha, even in just a particular situation, even in just a particular activity that you're engaged in, you experience the pleasant aspects of it to a degree that is otherwise unimaginable. That the mere fact of being alive and taking a breath, you experience that as sukha, that as pleasure. So that you find that you can eat delicious food, you can engage in sexual activity, you can experience the love of others, you can experience all of these things that our minds react to naturally with pleasure. And it's not that freedom from desire means that you don't experience pleasure anymore. It means you experience pleasure so much more fully than you ever did before. And it too is on a spectrum. If you just cut the tana in half, you'll enjoy the chocolate cake twice as much. And the same thing with aversion. Now, the wholesome counterpart of aversion is compassion. And when you see something that is wrong or harmful, or you experience something that's wrong or harmful, to the degree that tana is present, dukkha is present. But if tana is completely eliminated, all that is left is compassion. If it's somebody else's foot in the fire, you do everything you can to remove it, to soothe it, to heal it. If it's your foot in the fire, the same thing. You treat your foot no different than you would anybody else's. So in the second path, and I'll say something about that. In the second path, we're learning about tana, and we're learning about overcoming tana. And in the course of doing that, we start learning and understanding chanda as well. Now, so that's the difference between the two, and that's what that path is all about. And when you have mastered the second path, you reach the third path, where there is no longer tana associated with anything that happens in the world. Anything in the form realm you can experience without tana. But you can still experience it with chanda and compassion. Now I'm going to go back to the other thing that I've learned. And there's a lot of things that are only addressed obliquely in the Buddha's teaching. And because they're only expressed obliquely or hinted at, in much of the Buddha Dharma that's been taught, since the passing of the Buddha, they've tended to be neglected. And what this is the discovery of compassion as the component of chanda that stands in opposition to aversion. The opposite of aversion is compassion. It's loving kindness and compassion. It is sympathetic joy, loving kindness and compassion. And it is equanimity too, because the equanimity of it is the complete absence of tanha. Okay? In the divine abodes, equanimity is last, because as you gradually remove the tanha aspect of aversion and replace it with loving kindness, and then replace it with compassion, and then replace it with sympathetic joy, the tanha aversion component is getting less and less, and the loving kindness, compassion, and sympathetic joy component are becoming stronger. And when you've completely eliminated the tanha, you have arrived at equanimity. But that is that equanimity is not a non-feelingness. It's the richest kind of feelingness. Because you experienced pleasure as fully as you possibly could, and you experience the pleasure and happiness of others as fully as if it was your own, and that is sympathetic joy. And when you are in the presence of bad things, and the world is full of bad things, you don't experience the aversion of tanha. You experience compassion. What can I do? What can I do to change this? And so compassion is it's an essential component of fully mature equanimity. And until that compassion has fully developed, and until you've erased the last traces of tanha as aversion, you haven't achieved perfect equanimity. You're in a state of imperfect equanimity. And then, in your daily life, instead of there being all of these fleeting instances of tanha as desire and tanha as aversion, that instead you dwell in a place of loving kindness, then you see, compassion is doing something. It's the positive compulsion to act, just as tanha is the negative compulsion to act. But when there's nothing in particular that has to be acted upon through compassion, there's still something. And that's loving kindness. And that I see also as the embracing of the world as it is, fully. That you see and you experience feelings of kindness, and you act on that, and you are in a state of love. That, you know, there are strains of Buddhism that are strongly world denying, that say this is samsara and that nirvana is something different and you must completely abandon samsara. But this world it's both samsara and nirvana. It's only samsara when there is delusion and tanha and dukkha, then it's samsara. When those are absent, when you're in a state of perfect equanimity, you are dwelling in a perfect world with feelings of kindness and acts of compassion, and your joy, your own personal joy, the bliss of the partly awakened one becomes multiplied through sympathetic joy, because now your own happiness is to your own happiness is being added. The pleasure and the happiness and the satisfaction and the joy of every other being that you come in contact with and who shares that with you. So that if you share your happiness, your satisfaction, your pleasure at something that's happened with me, then I can take satisfaction and joy and pleasure in that as well. And it's as if, you know, now I've increased my own bliss because I've added yours to it. And that's the part that hasn't been adequately expressed and communicated so often in the Dharma. Somehow compassion is this thing that we don't put the proper emphasis on what it is, where it fits in to the whole picture. You know, it's like it's a piece of the puzzle that hasn't been put in the place to show how it connects with everything else and how it interacts with everything else. Same thing with loving kindness and sympathetic joy. They're kind of these pieces that I don't know where that goes. So we'll just stack these other four pieces over on the side of the Dharma. But we have to develop compassion. We have to develop loving kindness. We have to open our hearts up. We have to open our hearts up fully to the world. We have to experience the forest fires in California and the refugees from Syria and the human trafficking in Asia and all of these other things the same way we accept the sight of a pair of fawns or the fragrance of a flower or the beauty of the sky and the stars, because they are all one and the same. And we need to learn, and it's not easy to learn, to embrace all of those things in such a way that we are with them through loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Then we've put all of the pieces together in the puzzle. You know, and I admit very openly that some of those were pieces that I was missing, that wasn't missing entirely, but I'd never quite realized the extent to which they need to be there and to be a part of the whole thing. And so as seems to happen so often with all the people I've known, whether I've been in a role of teacher or just a spiritual companion and friend, we keep finding ourselves needing to go back and pick up the pieces that we missed along the way while charging ahead or while basking in the glorious magnificence of the awakening that we have achieved. We have to go back and do the parts of the work that we missed along the way.
Also asked about dependent origination.
Oh, you also asked about, yes, you did. Well, and that's another very good thing to address. Because all of this is so intimately connected. You see, the illusion is that we are a separate self. And there is an illusion that because we're separate, that our happiness and our suffering are coming from sources that are other. And this is all tied up in a perception that this separateness, I am a separate thing, and you are a separate thing, and this is a separate thing, and that's a separate thing. And we cling to these things. Even, impermanence is another lousy way of expressing things. But if you understand dependent origination, then you really understand impermanence and no self, and how it is that not understanding those produces so much suffering. So dependent arising is, the Buddha stated it as a principle of causality. When this is, that is. When this is not, that is not. And now, you look at that and say, yeah, right. I think I figured that out when I was about 6 years old. Stuff causes other stuff. But he was really speaking to two different things. He was speaking to people who, in their attempts to manipulate reality, believed that somehow this could be done in a way that stood outside of causality, that there was magic, that there were beings who that perhaps they could become one of those beings for whom causality no longer had its force, that they could have something without having the causes and conditions for it first. That, so he was addressing that. He was saying that absolutely nothing is, or absolutely everything, let's put it this way, absolutely everything is the result of causes and conditions. And furthermore, absolutely everything is cause and condition for other things. And then he pointed out that nothing has a single cause and condition. Nothing even has a finite number of causes and conditions. It's easy to say that the cause of an oak tree is an acorn, but then there are an infinite number of other things that had to happen for that acorn to ever become an oak tree. And that oak tree is itself a cause of so many, many things. And we could entertain ourselves for years, trying to identify all of the effects that oak tree out there has had on other things, other beings, other processes. I mean, ultimately, we even know that the weather is determined by trees, like that oak tree. Through their transpiration, they create the clouds that produce the rain. You cut down all the trees and it stops raining, turns into a desert. Why does cutting down trees stop rain and create a desert. It's just an example. The dependent arising as a principle of causality ultimately is saying, and I haven't filled in all the gaps here, but I think you can make the leap, that everything not only is a result of causes and conditions, the causes and conditions are everything else. And not only is everything a cause or condition for something else, everything is cause and condition for everything else. Because if we examine this web of interconnectedness, we find it is totally all-inclusive. Now, when we look at this more closely, we begin to see things not as things, but as processes. In the life of the oak, there was the acorn, but the causes and conditions that allowed the acorn to become a sprout and then a sapling and then a tree and then to exist for some number of years is a continuous stream of new causes and conditions which were connected to everything else in the universe that came into play in that. So now we see that tree as a process that is a part of a much greater process. And ultimately, what dependent arising, if we follow the logical steps one by one, and if we verify that through our observation in the world, the only possible conclusion that we can come to is that there are no things. There is only process. And we are processes within larger processes within larger processes until we come to the totality of all that is. So that's dependent arising. But dependent arising actually goes farther than that. There's a subtler development. In the history of Buddhism, There are a couple of schools, several Chinese Mahayana schools, who examined the sutras very carefully, and they came to the conclusion that when the Buddha first started teaching, he tried to teach this particular aspect of dependent arising that I'm going to tell you about now, but that he realized that it was so far beyond the comprehension of the vast majority of people that he spoke to, that it was pointless. And so we only find it mentioned in certain places. One of those Chinese Mahayana schools is Huayan, and the other is Tiantai. And if you wanted to find out more of this, you would study the works of those schools. The Huayan school is based on what's called the Flower Garland Sutra, or the Avadhatamsaka Sutra. But this other aspect of dependent origination, that or dependent arising, that the Buddha discovered, that goes beyond the fact that everything is one vastly, totally interconnected process, is that everything is interpenetrating in a way that we would describe as holistic or holographic. That we really and truly are all one in a way that goes beyond even our causal interconnectedness as a single process. It's not just that you and I and that bowl are parts, are processes within a much larger process. That I am you and you are me and we are both this bowl. And this bowl is both of us. And the entire universe is actually in, you may have heard this phrase before, in every grain of sand. And so that's the other aspect of dependent arising. But you see how dependent arising, seeing that we are processes, means that we're not separate individuals. The idea of anatta, of no self, there's no room for selfhood in processes that are part of bigger processes, right? Impermanence. Well, impermanence doesn't mean that things don't last. It means that things aren't. That it's only our mind and the scale that our mind operates on that causes us to see things. Minds that operate on different scales, I mean, that mountain certainly wouldn't see us as things. We are so fleeting to the mountain, right? And could an ant ever perceive a mountain? How? To an ant, a little pebble this size is a mountain. And if it, well, for that matter, when you drive into this canyon, you're rising 1,000 feet. How many of you are aware of that when you drive into this canyon? Right? It's all scale. It's all scale. And that's what I'm illustrating here. And so, the appearance of things is an illusion created by our minds. And our minds only create things out of process on a particular scale. And there are other scales. But there really are no things. There really is only process. And so that's where dependent arising and its ramifications are, in a sense, they encompass the whole of the Dharma. There is absolutely nothing in the Dharma that I've seen that can't be derived directly from dependent arising. And we have very little information about what the Buddha's awakening consisted of. There's a couple of different descriptions that you'll come across. And in one of them, he says what he realized in his meditation was dependent arising forward and backward and seeing and went through it over and over again. That got written down 500 years later as the links of dependent arising, which is merely a description of what happens in the mind of a single person. But if you look at that and you can say, okay, wow, it could very well be that the Buddha, when he realized dependent arising, that he sat there and the more he explored it, the more he discovered, and that the entire Dharma that he taught ultimately derived from that original basis. Now that's just my speculation. Well, no, it's not just mine. I should say that's only a speculation that I strongly hold, but there are a number of other people that I respect very, very much who share that same speculation. So, that's the dependent arising part. Please ask for clarification.
I think it's time for us to take a break.
Do you have a question?
It was a clarification. It's sort of a question that I haven't formulated well enough to ask yet. In regards to the concept of scale that you were talking about earlier, and scale of consciousness. Just this thing that I've observed, especially in group efforts, where people are working together, it's sort of. And I still the question's just not fully formed yet, so I'm not quite sure how to ask it in terms of you know, when people work together, there seems to be this group consciousness and group unconsciousness.
Oh, absolutely, totally, yes, you're absolutely right. And there is a group consciousness associated with every group of every side. That's why nations appear different to us. There's a group consciousness that defines Canada differently than the United States and differently than North Korea.
My question, I think, boils down to sort of skillful means inside of that, you know, being a part of that group consciousness and how to behave skillfully and sort of move it along. But I haven't quite formulated that question yet. It's only just started developing, so.
Yeah, well, keep working on it. It's a really good thing because, you know, that is what all of the great and important people in history have done, whether for good or ill, is they have found a way to alter the direction of that group consciousness. And what you want to do is to find a way to do that skillfully and in a positive way that is very doable. Nelson Mandela and Martin Luther King did it. So did Pol Pot and Hitler and Mao Zedong. So do it skillfully.
Subject of,
can you hold that to your mouth?
Can you hear that?
Yeah, it's, you have to kind of aim it directly at your mouth. You can't hold it below.
Can you hear that now?
That's perfect.
Good. Well, I just, in thinking about the group consciousness, for the past few days, I've been aware of many, many groups of people who are evolving consciousness, who are working on a global peace effort that they started in June, and it's ending and going to end with a whole effort of millions of people all over the world focusing their attention on world peace. And they feel that, you know, this could be have a very powerful effect. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's a really wonderful thing. And if they go about it right, it could be very good. There's all kinds of levels at which people can be united around an idea. And some are effective, more effective than others. I don't think at this point that there is very much of a, I mean, you could have a group consciousness consisting of individuals who are dispersed around the world, but the mind system of the world as a whole is at the moment about the most ununified mind system that you could conceive of. So within the mind system as a whole, we can unify parts of it, and that's what every group and every group consciousness does and is. I'll point one thing out that it's not really an answer so much to your comment. I think this is absolutely wonderful, and I'm glad people are doing this and keep doing this. Just like I'm glad that people are out there saying that Black Lives Matter and everything else. But when we speak of group consciousness, remember, groups aren't things. They're processes. They're fluid. They grow and they shrink and they lose parts and they gain parts and they change direction. Mm-hmm. To speak of a group consciousness is to speak of an extremely fluid process. You are a process, but you are a less fluid process than any human group process. I think there are group processes in the universe that are far more unified and cohesive than the group process, than the process, conscious process that any person represents. But they aren't on this planet. Every group and every group consciousness is something that is constantly shifting and changing, and it is nothing more than a process. So it's important to remember that. That is a very good thing. Well, also, it's like everything. It's all of the things have their dangerous side. So good groups with good group consciousness can be corrupted and become bad groups with bad group consciousness.
But what's this about not on this planet?
Yeah.
What's not on this planet?
There are consciousnesses of a kind that there are consciousnesses that are on a level, if you could imagine all of the human beings on this planet forming a fully unified mind system, if you could picture that, imagine that, I believe there already exist mind systems at that level.
Well, that's great.
And I believe that...
Are they going to affect... Are they working with the mind system on this planet?
Hey, you know, that's like an ant trying to figure out what I'm doing. You're asking me... The thing is, I think we see things from the point of view of time. But in so many ways, it has been demonstrated that time is an illusion. And Immanuel Kant was the first one to articulate it clearly. Time is a creation of the human mind only. Mm-hmm. Time and space. Since that's been demonstrated by many, many people in many ways. But it's the only way we can look at things. Since we're looking at things from the point of view of time, I think the entire universe is going to become a unified mind system in what we would call a future. The entire universe is going to become an awakened being in what we would call the future. But if we realize that time is just an illusion, then we can take some comfort in the idea that it's actually already happened. It just looks like we're not there yet.
If our minds could see it.
If our minds could see it.
It's already there, already done.
Yeah. So now I think it's definitely time to shut down the talkathon.